On today's episode, I'm in the Labour seat of Bradford West. I'll be talking to Naz Shah, the local Labour MP, about how she won her seat from George Galloway and how she can combat frustrations with politicians over the conflict in the Middle East. This seat has the largest Muslim population of any seat on my list, and I'll be looking at what Muslim voters want from the main parties and what can be done to make sure that integration and multiculturalism works in the UK. Hello and welcome to Pod Zone Country, the politics podcast from the Yorkshire Post. I'm Mason Boycott Owen, the paper's Westminster correspondent, and this is Battleground Yorkshire, our election series where I explore 12 seats in 12 weeks to find the story behind the polls ahead of the next election. Today I am in Bradford West. The city is set to undergo a transformation in the coming years after being named the UK City of Culture for 2025. In recent years, the city has been somewhat left behind by its glitzier neighbour of Leeds, but the potential for investment in arts, tourism and transport could see it flourish in the coming years. Earlier, I caught up with the Labour MP, Naz Shah, to find out a bit more about her hopes for the seat and what issues it still needs to overcome. Naz, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. In terms of your seat, obviously you have quite a decent majority, but now that Labour has quite a substantial poll lead over the Tories, how do you go about campaigning in a seat that, you know, to an outsider it may seem like, you know, it's a bit of a done deal?
Well, look, Mason, the truth is, yes, that I have a really, really good majority. The people of Bradford West have been very, very supportive of the Labour Party. But we can't take that for granted because it's just not what we can do, and I certainly don't. So I'm very, very, very committed to what's happening in the constituency. So we've still got to work hard on door knocking. So I'm out this weekend, I was out last weekend. We've got the local elections going on at the moment. So I'm still working hard with my, you know, within in the constituency to try and make sure that we get the vote out, and next week's going to be no different.
And in terms of the issues that you're hearing on the doorstep, are they the same issues, you know, facing every seat across the country, or are there specific ones just for Bradford West?
So I think there's the cost of living crisis is one of the big things. We've got the issue of, there's three specific issues in the constituency that keep coming up time and time again. One is the nitrous oxide gas, the balloon issue. We've got dangerous driving issue, and we've got fireworks, which is why I supported Judith Cummins in her 10-minute rule bill this week, last week, to reduce the noise of fireworks, because that's a very, very live issue in terms of a local constituency stuff. The other stuff is no different to the rest of the country in terms of a cost of living crisis, mortgage crisis, you know, the job stuff. That's you know, a third of the families in Bradford are experiencing poverty. That's, you know, with, that's a lot of children. And I went out to see the Jude's Kitchen this last week, and when I was there, they were telling me that there are across Bradford more than 30,000, I think it was, or even 40,000 children that have to skip a meal every day. And that's in, you know, in 2024 with the sixth largest economy, that kind of stat, that, you know, when at the moment, where I was watching the, listening to the debate last night, the London mayoral debate, the idea that we're not giving out the free school meal stuff, you know, that Sadiq has just announced for London. And again, it makes a difference to children. It makes a difference to their attention. It makes a difference to their health. It makes a difference to their outcomes. You know, these are the bread and butter stuff of politics, everyday politics, which are really, really important for the people of Bradford West. And there are others, that the other thing that is really, really, really heavy in terms of casework right now is the Palestine, Israel-Gaza conflict right now. And we've had a lot of casework on that in the thousands. So we are, that's something that's very, very close to the heart of Bradfordians and my constituents. And, or, you know, unemployment rates are high in compared to England, and, you know, like England's average is what, 3.8%. Ours is 7.1%, so more than 7%. So you've got a lot of deprivation, and it's really interesting. Bradford is, you know, it's got real, real high pockets of deprivation, and we've got one of the fastest, you know, going rates of child poverty across Yorkshire and Humber. And that was, I think it was according to, I'm trying to think whether it was Joseph Rowntree or the Trussell Trust, one of the other, that released their figures. So those kind of things impact on my constituents, and that really does come up on the doorstep. The doorstep is... The mortgage issue, the economy crashing, the Liz Truss fiasco, that comes up on the doorstep. Even to be fair, I've spoken to some Tory, former Tory voters who voted Tories all their life, and they've said to me, they said, "Naz, we're not going to vote Tory again, you know, so we can't do that after what we see what's going on." So those are the kind of issues that I'm coming across the door.
And how do we put more of a focus on Bradford going forward as a city in Yorkshire? Obviously, Leeds has, you know, seen a massive focus in terms of, you know, money, investment and the spotlight from central government. How do we kind of change that to make the focus more about Bradford going forward? Because it's, you know, a city with a lot of potential.
So you'll know this, Mason. The truth is that Bradford hasn't had its fair share, and winning 2025 was huge for the city. And it says what it does on the tin kind of thing. You know, it's our time to shine, and it's our, you know, taking our space. That's really, really important. But there's a wider issue, isn't there, which is what I'm going to be campaigning on, is Labour has committed to the Northern Powerhouse Rail. That rail infrastructure in Bradford is really, really needed. I've done a lot of work on it over the last few years. If we look at the idea that you go to Wakefield and it takes you longer, you know, to go to Wakefield now than it would in Edwardian times on the rail, you know, direct rail, you know, that's a source of shame. Because it's not what we should have. We've got the 10th largest economy in the whole country. We're the 4th largest actual council metropolitan district in the whole of the country. So you've got London, Birmingham, it's Manchester, and then it's Bradford. So you've got Bradford is massive in terms of land space. You know, it's got an economy which is worth billions. Why haven't we had that fair share of our, you know, slice of the cake for our people in Bradford across the district? So I think, you know, the devolution with, you know, with Tracy having coming in, you know, the impact on the buses, the impact on the conversation that they're having on the mass transit system, you know, across Yorkshire, that would be really, really helpful. Those are the kind of things I want to see, Mason, because those kind of things will impact on the economic infrastructure of the city, to raise the city, to raise the bar of the city, to give confidence to the city, to then attract more money into Bradford. So when you're talking about investors, private investors, the land to value doesn't add up. So you're spending, say, £100, you're only getting £90 back per pound. So those are the kind of things we'll be able to have much more control over when we're in government. And that's what I'm hoping for us to be. Because every MP, and especially when you're talking about the majority of the councils across the country that are the most deprived are Labour areas out of the top 10. You know, so those are, and the Tories, as much as they say they're responding to levelling up and they're balancing it out, the fact is we've known that since Robert Jenrick, since I was in communities, shadow communities and local government team, we know that they've targeted their constituents, which are marginals, to put money in. And how do you compare the Bradford West constituency and the deprivation statistics, say, to somewhere in Harrogate? It doesn't square. You know, you can't square that. It's this whole you cannot square. So those are the kind of things that we're up against. If we're in government, those are the kind of things we can advocate for, which targets poverty and deprivation and infrastructure where it's needed the most. Because at the moment, it's not doing that. It's failing. The levelling up has just become a gimmick, as far as I'm concerned. Yes, we've had the 25 million and 20 million. I'm really, really pleased that we've had that from, you know, in the first round of the levelling up. But 20 million doesn't cut it. When we look at how much infrastructure cost that we've lost with local councils, you know, the councils have been, it's like they've been picking, the Tory party have been, over the last 9 years that I've been in this position, it's like they've been picking at the flesh of, you know, taking bits and bits and bits of it until it gets to its bare bone. And then, okay, we'll try and tick sticky plaster around it, and it's just it's frustrating. It drives me insane. It drives me absolutely so angry to see this is what they've done to people in my constituency and those that I represent. So those are the kind of things we'll be able to refocus on fiscally. You know, Rachel Reeves at the helm, inshallah, for me, you know, if we have a Labour government, we can start talking about these economic policies that will impact on it. They will actually impact on the voters in my constituency. That's where I want to see a difference. We don't want to miss a whole generation of prosperity, of social mobility, because it can happen. But you have to have, for me, you have to have the culture and the mindset which is committed to that social mobility, which is committed to that equality and fairness. And at the moment, we don't have that.
In terms of the demographics of the city, it has a very large Muslim population, and obviously Israel-Palestine will be a key concern for many of those. But in terms of an area of policy, how do you get across the idea of change and hope and what a Labour government's going to do to help matters in the Middle East when, for so many people looking at it from the outside, it seems like there's very little hope of there being peace long term?
I think there is, there has to be. We have to have hope, right? Politics is all about hope, hoping that things change, hoping that things get better. And that's when people vote and they mark their tick. It's about wanting something better. And I am David Lammy. We had a urgent question last week on the humanitarian crisis. We now, you've got these unconfirmed reports, but reports of, which need to be investigated by the United Nations. The Labour Party are clear on the ICJ, and that we support the investigations into all of these things. We have done historically. Labour's always been in that position. Labour has always been in 2014 under Ed Miliband's leadership. They walked the floor on the vote of recognition for Palestine. So yes, we have to have hope. We have to have hope that the hostages are returned. We have to have hope that the, there's an end to the violence. We have to, and that's what keeps us going, doesn't it? Because it's so, we just celebrated Eid recently, and Eid was so bittersweet for all the families, the Muslim families in particular that I know, because it's like you're fasting. And the whole point of fasting is resetting your connection with God, but also it's about the humility and resetting your relationship with life itself, and having that experience of spirituality and that taking from, and reminding yourself of what's important in life and your role in not just in terms of your own family, but your role globally as a human being and humanity. And that was really, really brought home, because it was, you're watching your screens, and everybody does this. You try not to on a night, but you flick through Instagram, and the atrocities that you see before you are just so painful. So it's been really, really painful. It's been painful Eid, and that affects my constituents, and it's a really, really big issue. And we have to work with hope that the Labour Party comes in, that recognition of Palestine, having a conversation, having something robust in place, so we can get, because let's be honest, Mason, Netanyahu is no bedfellow for peace. He never has been. But there's people in his cabinet that are absolutely horrific, in terms of their language. And even the protests in Israel by Israelis against the government, against its policies. So if we are really, really a true friend to Israel and Palestine, then we have to play our part. We have an historic obligation as well, because the Balfour Declaration was something that came from Britain. So we have the other half of that still needs to be honoured, which is a state for the Palestinians. And so we've got a lot of work to do. And I think we if a Labour Party comes in, I'm certainly going to be working towards doubling down on the efforts that we're making to help in resolve the issue in the Middle East, because that is dangerous. That's dangerous on not just for what's going on in Palestine. It's the idea that so many children have died. And I don't know if you saw my letter to Gaza, because I feel so helpless on behalf of my constituents. Over 35,000 people, Mason, have died. The majority of them being women and children. That is it. And it's going to be 7 months next week. You know, 7 months of this going on, and the reports that are coming out daily. It really does, you know, rob you of your sleep, because you really, really feel. I feel so totally helpless and trying to do whatever I can to raise awareness to do. So I do a lot of work with Labour Friends of Palestine and part of the executive. So that's the, you know, that hope. I'm hoping that we can build that into something. But let's see. But it is painful.
Yeah, it's a very emotive subject. And I guess that's one of the things that some elements of politics in the UK have kind of tried to tap into, you know, whether that's the level of anger or frustration or, you know, potentially even more uglier emotions than that. How did you combat things like that against George Galloway when you ran against him and successfully unseated him? Because obviously now he's back on the scene in politics, and we're starting to see, you know, tensions and divisions rise over Israel-Palestine in a way that we've not seen for, you know, quite a while.
I think for me, look, I'm the only member of parliament who's ever unseated George Galloway. So he's fought many elections, but I'm the only one who's unseated him as a sitting MP in Bradford West. And, you know, it was one of my proudest moments of, you know, sharing that joy with my constituents who voted for me. This isn't about Galloway, Mason. This is about those actors. And that is the same when it comes to Reform Party, the Farages, the Galloways. And the reason that void is there is because we haven't seen the last 14 years, certainly, we haven't seen that strong leadership from our leaders. So if we look at, we go back to referendum, you know, the idea that at the time David Cameron promised that and went out to the polls in 2015 on the back of that, and he, you know, his that set off a series of events that we're still, you know, involved in with Brexit, etc., and that has had a huge economic impact. You know, these characters, you can't. I'm not focused on this is what Farage has said, this is what Galloway has said, this is what, you know, this is what them people say. For me, leadership, when you're in a position of power and you're in that position of leadership and people are looking to you, you have to set your stall. And I said this to others when they asked me, how did I beat Galloway? It was, you have to lead. And leadership isn't about pointing out their flaws. It's not about, you can either take a language of this is where they're wrong, but actually demonstrate and show people the alternative. This is what, and by definition, you're highlighting their incompetencies. But it's whether you take a approach of, I'm beating him or I'm winning for you. And there's a difference. There's a difference in the language you use. I am not out to beat him. I am out to win for you. For you are my constituents. I want to win because I want to give you something which is better than what there is at the moment. And people are not stupid. Voters are not stupid. When you give them real, when you're congruent, when you're authentic, when you're leading for them, and it's for them. Because politics has had been eroded, hasn't it? The language of politics. I mean, somebody was on, I think it was the BBC, one of the ministers were up and Laura Koonsberg was asking, you know, you've got so many MPs suspended, sex pests, all the rest of it in Parliament. It's like, you know, that is a shame. That's a shame on this great place. That's embarrassing. That's horrific, really. That this is a place where power should be used for the benefit of the people, and it's not. People are using it for their personal gains in terms of those that have been suspended. Their investigations are going on. You know, so we've got to give that trust back to the people, because people don't trust politicians. And why should they, when there's so many people, you know, being suspended, etc.? But the vast majority of people do come here. And I say that across the house, they come here because they want to make a difference.
As I touched upon earlier, Bradford West has the highest proportion of Muslim voters of any seat in Yorkshire. And with that comes some questions over how do we make integration and multiculturalism work in the 21st century in Yorkshire and the wider region. To find out just that, I spoke to Jahangir Mohammed from the Iron Institute, a think tank dedicated to trying to solve the solutions facing Muslims today. Jahangir, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So what are the key issues facing Muslim voters at this next election?
Well, obviously, at the moment, something that's very painful and traumatic for the Muslim community is what's happening in Gaza and the images that we all see, and bearing in mind that the Muslim community doesn't really focus on the mainstream media, has access to media all over the world. So they see pictures that the rest of society may not see, although in the age of social media, a lot of that is available. So that's particularly traumatic and painful. And I'd say it's at the top of their list in terms of finding an end to that and supporting the Palestinian cause and finding a solution to that. And there's a lot of unhappiness with the mainstream political parties on what they see as total support for the state of Israel and really nothing for the Palestinians. So there's a lot of anger about that. But generally, I think, the Muslim community has seen this country at war or involved in wars in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, in Afghanistan, and now in Gaza. Both the US and the UK governments have had some involvement. So I think the Muslims just want to see an end to wars, political parties supporting wars in their part of the world, which they come from and which they see, and which causes untold misery, destruction, and lots of refugees. And we can see that in the work of our charities, where they're constantly dealing with war zones and conflicts to provide aid and relief. And we just really want to see an end to that. And that's a common frustration and anger at the political parties, that they seem to not want to bring those wars to an end.
And how do we have a respectful and calm and clear conversation and dialogue over issues as emotive as this? You know, obviously we've seen tensions rise in the region, but obviously there are some frustrations here back home as well.
Yeah, I think obviously there's a lot of anger and there's divisive views on all sides. But I think by and large, I think, given that Gaza is holy land for Muslims, Palestine, and it's the land of our prophets as well as of other religions, and it has the third holiest mosque for Muslims on it. I think the response has been really we haven't seen any major incidents. And I think it has been largely respectful. Obviously, politics is the arena of language, and we see that with the debate on migrants and whatever. So people do, there will always be an element of that. But I think by and large, it's been handled quite well. We don't really see tensions between communities on that issue, although there are polarized views between supporters of Israel and supporters of the Palestinian cause.
And looking at seats that have, a large Muslim population, how do we make sure that, multiculturalism works well in the UK, that integration works well, that, communities are able to connect and get on in a positive way?
Yeah, I think a major issue, I think you touched on this earlier, is language and also targeting of communities and for political purposes. And, politicians do that a lot, and the mainstream media, where, Muslims are constantly in the news presented as a threat. And that impacts people who really have no contact with the Muslim community, particularly in non-Muslim areas. So that their worldview is framed around that, and that can cause tension. So I would say a major way we can reduce those tensions is to get politicians and the mainstream media to be more responsible in the way that they conduct their politics and not sort of attack marginalized communities who really have no power to shape the debate in the media and to sort of put an alternative narrative. I think that's one of the ways. I think the Muslim community themselves have realized that they need to deal with that image that's been portrayed of them, and they've started sort of opening their mosques, having open days, doing food banks, reaching out to the wider community to show they are not what they are being portrayed as in the media. But there's a lot more to be done. I think schools have a major role to play in tackling Islamophobia, just as they do with anti-Semitism. But Islamophobia, you know, anti-Muslim hate, an understanding of the Islamic faith and the Muslim community and its contribution to the past and the present. I mean, we don't really look at the contribution of Muslims. They've changed the makeup of this country. You go to any high street or any local shopping center, you know, perhaps people won't remember. I mean, certainly when my and the first generation came here, you didn't have all these wonderful foods and culture as available. My mother used to make yogurt in the home because yogurt wasn't available for sale in this country. So this country has changed immensely by migration and the Muslim community, and added to the culture and brought wealth as a result of that, despite the deindustrialization and the loss of jobs. So I think sometimes we don't focus on those things and focus on all the negatives too much, and we don't see the reality.
For areas like Bradford West, how does integration between, you know, a large Muslim population and the rest of the area work well? How do, you know, what's the blueprint and the key to these, you know, inter-community relations?
Yeah, I think if you just look at the economic success of those areas and, you know, how many people work in those areas, how many people come and visit, including the non-Muslim communities come and eat in those areas or do shopping. You know, the amazing display of culture that's available. And increasingly we see it in sport and sporting activities. So sometimes I think it's just a case of actually bringing people's attention, focusing it, you know, whether it's schools, visiting the areas. Obviously, one of the challenges we've got, and it's not just within the Muslim community, is, you know, society, in the days of the mills, when the first generation were here, the workplace was where people integrated. And once that's declined, that nothing really has replaced that. So you might get the council is the largest employer, but you don't really have venues or places where people can mix, unless it's in clubs and pubs and nightclubs, where the younger generation, certainly some of that happens. But, you know, university is another place. But, you know, we don't really, I think economic prosperity is a key. But even in the workplace, I mean, we have challenges where people these days work from home. So I think integration is not just something that is something just between Muslims and non-Muslims or different faiths. I mean, I live on a street which is a professional street, and I rarely see my neighbours maybe at Christmas or, you know, everybody's busy, they go in and out. So we're not really, you know, a cohesive people anymore in society. The way society works has changed. Everything's on the internet. We deal with the internet. Kids are those communication skills that people had, one-to-one have been lost. So I think there's a wider debate about how the whole of society becomes more connected to each other and understanding of each other. I don't think it's something that politicians can engineer. I don't think social engineering works. People do cluster together, but as they prosper and as they become wealthier, they tend to move to other areas and do other things. I think economic success and educational success is a major cause of that. And we are seeing a lot more people moving into different areas and, as I say, mixing in different fields. But obviously, as a society, we need to rethink how, working class, middle class, rich, poor, different communities. Sometimes even within the same community, there's wide gaps in terms of integration. So on council housing, we've seen that where, the poorest get put into one street, one block, and they're all on the council housing, and that creates a cohesion problem. So these are big issues, really. But I do think the more we progress as a community, in some ways it's a time factor, and the more economic prosperity there is, and the more confident people become, that's a natural thing that happens.
And in terms of these confident leaders, is there anything more that the Muslim community can do to be more active in integration and taking part in, these inter-community relationships?
Yeah, I think they can showcase a lot of that, but also think tanks like ours. One of our priorities is to, we did a report on the work of our charities, international charities, and we're doing work on UK and the mosques, is to show, how much that Muslims contribute to this society, and for us as the Muslim organisations to actually push that message out and to show others, because it's got to come from the most confident people in the community. People who don't have that confidence are not going to be able to do that. And a lot of the people in Muslim communities, although it's getting better with the younger becoming more educated, and are still very much don't have the confidence to go out and deal with others. If you've not worked outside your area for decades, it is difficult. And then on top of that, if you on the one hand you've got the mainstream community who are reading all the stories in the media about the Muslim threat and what Muslims are up to, and grooming gangs and all this, that also affects the Muslim community. As they read more and more of that, and then they see the response to those, there's a tendency to look inwards and to sort of think, my God, people hate us. And I think a lot of people outside of the community or in positions of power, whether in schools, whether in politics or councillors, have to take the lead on that. It can't be the responsibility of those who are struggling to survive, whether it's the white working class or the Muslim community. You can't put that onus and burden on them. We can only create more avenues, but you can't force people to come to a mosque to learn about it. We just have to encourage Muslim institutions, non-Muslim institutions, to work better at it.
That's all we've got time for this week. If you liked what you heard, then subscribe to the Yorkshire Post for more interviews and analysis from me this weekend. Next week, I'm in the Tory safe seat of Skipton and Ripon, and more importantly, my hometown. I'll be talking about if Labour can win this tricky North Yorkshire seat and explore our topic of the week, education, to see how big a priority this is for voters ahead of polling day. See you then.